Hey, everybody. I want to apologize. Last time, as I recall, when I signed up, I said, I'm out of here, in typical Patricia Corey lingo slang. But I'm back, and welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that dares you to think outside the box of convention. As you are doing, as you are going to be really involved in doing more and more as these days play out, as we move through this immense, shocking, crazy paradigm shift that we're in and move toward a new horizon. Boy, are we ready for that. So, as you know, I like to bring you cutting-edge thinkers and true leaders in breaking down the old thought of humankind and how we got here and where we're from and all that establishment thought. And one of the people who I think does this very well, taking us back to Egypt, is dear Christopher Dunn, who came on my show some time ago and is featured in my book, Beyond the Matrix, Daring Conversations with Brilliant Minds of Our Times. Do read this book. Well, I've got him back because he's got this amazing new book out. I mean, I can't imagine a mind like this. It's called Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, Advanced Engineering in the Temples of the Pharaohs. And here he is. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, Patricia. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, it's great to have you back. You know, I'm not going to read too much about your bio because it's such a lengthy read, but we do want people to understand that you've got an engineering, manufacturing background, and yet, as I recall the last time we were on, you said, oh, here we go, we're going off in this direction, and we were very esoteric, blending science and spirit, which is the point of my show and the book that you're featured in. So I know you're going to blow our minds again today, talking about where you've gone since the book, The Giza Power Plant, which, you know, that book just really changed the course of my own thinking, I'm sure many others, describing the pyramid as a holistic energy device that is harmonically coupled with the earth and its inhabitants. And here you are now, just going berserk in the temples of the pharaohs. Talk to us. How did you get here?
Well, you know, the Giza power plant, as you said, it was a fairly radical theory and highly controversial.
Do you think?
Do I think? Well, I knew that it would, it would get some attention. It would have negative attention on one side, and maybe some people would appreciate it on the other. Because the Great Pyramid, when I was reading books about the Great Pyramid in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of questions about it and a lot of different theories. And it occurred to me that what needed was a comprehensive explanation for the Great Pyramid, explaining all the numerous features within the Great Pyramid, which most theories really didn't answer all the questions satisfactorily to me, anyway. And so that's what set me down the path to try and understand the Great Pyramid.
Okay, well, for the people who didn't have the pleasure of hearing you the last time you were on or who haven't read your book yet, can you give us a very brief overview of that explanation of the pyramid?
Sure.
And the function.
Yeah, essentially the Great Pyramid or the Giza Power Plant presents a theory which takes into account all known evidence within the Great Pyramid in the context of the pyramid being a machine. And my perception of it being a machine is based on the design of the interior chambers, passageways, and unusual shafts, and also the materials with which it was made, it was constructed of. And the King's Chamber particularly, because the King's Chamber has always been a huge mystery because of why did the ancient Egyptians choose to build this particular chamber out of granite, and they brought thousands and thousands of tons of granite 500 miles down the Nile to construct this interior chamber. And also above the chamber, the resonate, what they call the relieving chambers, as they are conventionally known, are not really relieving anything, but they're just holding up their own weight. So the stated purpose for these thousands of tons of granite didn't really make sense to me, but putting them together with evidence that you find in the subterranean chamber, the Queen's Chamber, so-called Queen's Chamber, the Grand Gallery specifically, which is an architectural wonder, and also has some very unusual, mysterious features within it, basically came up with the theory that the Great Pyramid was coupled to the Earth harmonically, and there is evidence to show that it is still resonating at a particular frequency. The King's Chamber resonates to an F-sharp chord. That was detected by Tom Danley in 1995. But the Great Pyramid originally was driven to harmony, to the harmony of the Earth. And in turn, the Earth returned energy to the Great Pyramid. It was a coupled oscillator. And a coupled oscillator is a device which, when tuned to the frequency of a larger vibrating body, will continue to draw energy from that body and vibrate in unison with it, or a harmonic thereof. The vibrations coming through the pyramid were converted to an airborne sound. They affected the granite within the King's Chamber and hydrogen that was generated in the Queen's Chamber and filled the Great Pyramid and flowed into the King's Chamber. It was driven to a high energy state. An input signal of hydrogen microwave energy coming through the northern shaft drew energy, or collected energy, in the King's Chamber, and it was directed through the southern shaft to the outside. And that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, okay. For us lay people here, that's pretty complicated. But your point was that this was pretty much a fountain of energy for keeping the whole Earth. As I recall, weren't you talking about this being a method for keeping the Earth harmonies in balance around the planet, or specifically an energy device to harvest energy for the region?
Yeah, I mean, my original thought was that it was specifically a utilitarian device, that it was basically without mind to any other function, it was used to create energy. My thinking has changed since then, and when we take into consideration all the pyramids in Egypt and the different designs, it appears to me that their original function was to actually drive the planet, or to cause vibration within the Earth's plates, the tectonic plates, to relieve the stresses that were being built up, that build up over time and cause stresses where the different plates meet, where you have the subduction zones and between the African plate, the European plate. So
sure.
There you have circumstances there that you can build up the energy where you have an earthquake, and that the pyramids would relieve those stresses so that they would alleviate the an earthquake from happening. So the stresses would be relieved over time rather than building up and then a sudden release which causes mass destruction.
Well, with all the ELF waves that are being sent into the Earth's core by various, well, we won't get into too much conspiracy theory for the moment. Do you believe that the existing pyramid networks around the planet are still functioning in that capacity? Or do you think that they've been drowned out by the noise that's being sent into the planet?
Well, I think the mechanical energy of the Earth is still affecting the pyramids. The machinery within the Great Pyramid, which was in the subterranean chamber that actually which actually drove the pyramid to vibrate and also the place to vibrate is no longer there. So as far as it functioning at its intended level, no, I don't believe that the pyramids are actually functioning like they originally did. However, I do think, and you know, it has been proven that the Great Pyramid, at least, is still responding to the energies of the Earth, and those frequencies can be picked up inside the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, well, I will. I would love to go keep discussing about this, but I've got to get into your new book. So I would like to recommend people to pick up that book, The Giza Power Plant, and read it, because it is a masterpiece. And before we continue, I want you to take down the information for Chris's website, which is www.gizapower.com, where you can get plenty of information about his previous work. Now, I would like to ask you, from there, from this intense study of the plateau and the pyramids, you have really branched out, and your book goes into more of the engineering in the temples, sacred geometry, Fibonacci sequence and design. It's very exciting. So how did you make that shift? What motivated you to take this leap into this other level of information and study?
Well, yeah, you know, a part of the Giza Power Plant actually deals with how the ancient Egyptians were able to cut stone so precisely and so efficiently. So that is a chapter in the Giza Power Plant, Advanced Machining in Ancient Egypt. The Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt is really a book that amplifies that aspect of the Giza Power Plant in a way that is more mainstream, in my opinion, because it does not introduce any it's not a book that changes the historical perspective on ancient Egypt, only in a manner which says that what is contained in the ancient Egyptians' toolbox is not capable of producing the artifacts that we see on the ground. And really, it is a study of the brilliant engineers that existed in prehistory, and that they have not been given credit, the credit they deserve in the past. And certainly, you don't find proper credit in conventional literature that still maintains that all the Egyptians had in their toolbox was copper tools, stone balls, wooden mallets, and very primitive, simple tools. But then when you compare the tools to the pieces that I highlight in Lost Technologies, it's obvious to at least every engineer that has read my book has essentially confirmed that there is a huge question mark, and you have to reject the conventional view. And so, Patricia, I decided after the Great Pyramid that the history books were not going to be changed based on the Giza Power Plant, because educators, academics have pretty much ignored it because of the nature of the book.
Sure. Outside the box of conventional thinking,
it's too far out on the fringe. And so, what I needed to do, if I wanted to influence the way Egyptologists approach their work, I had to write a book that was irrefutable. I mean, they can't ignore it. And I don't. When you have the testimony of professional engineers and professional people from other walks of life, scientists, etc., who endorse the Lost Technologies and say, you know, we can't ignore this evidence anymore. We have to start looking at it in a different way. Such as Robert Schock, who wrote a wonderful endorsement for my book and said that it indisputably shows that the ancient Egyptians were much more advanced than previously believed. These were the objectives as I wrote Lost Technologies. And so the reason for the book is actually to put in every other researcher's hands proof positive that, you know, we're not crazy. When we kind of intuit that there was something going on in prehistory is not being taught to the school children or, you know, students in college or high school. We have long thought that there is a piece of our history that has been missing. But as much as we cry or try to persuade academics to change their tune and, you know, and teach something different to our school children, most voices are being ignored. And, you know, the alternate historians such as, you know, Paul Zumbergier with Mourning of the Magicians, Eric von Daniken, Chariots of the Gods, and Graham Hancock, Robert Bavall, Robert Shark, Stephen Mailer, a whole host of researchers and writers who have had a different perspective on ancient history can take this book and it actually supports a point of view not necessarily maybe my point of view, because even in the alternate historical field there are different points of view and disagreements.
Sure.
But this at least it gives everybody a solid foundation to say, well, you know, there is definitely something going on back there, and this is proof positive that what we have been taught in school is incorrect.
Well, I mean, to consider, as I like to remind people, that we talk about ancient history 10,000, 20,000 years ago, and we look at the last 100 years in human history, and I find it surprising that people can't imagine that over a 10,000-year cycle, we could have had the ultimate technology, the crash of that, the return to that high technology, and the crash again, and still many, many cycles of highs and lows in human technology. If you just look at what we've done in 100 years,
right,
it's pretty silly to think that we couldn't have had those peaks before. So let's talk about... Well, first of all, our mutual friend Stephen Mailer has just told me he's going to take me to Abu Ghosh finally. I have never been there, and you're credited with discovering something pretty intense there. Would you like to talk about the pink granite slab, the stone?
Yes, this is what a good friend of mine, Dr. Alan Andrews, has described as the new Rosetta Stone. Also, Ed Malkowski, who went with me there in 2007, labeled it the same way. This is a piece of granite that is lying near the pyramid of Abu Ruwash. It is about 47 inches by 57 inches by about 10 inches thick. But it has a curved surface, and the curved surface ends with a radius. So it has what we call a compound radius. So regardless of which axis you look at it, you're going to see a radius. So the surface is radial, and where the saw finished cutting, that is radial too. It's very difficult to describe, you know, verbally. You have to have... You really need to look at a photographs, and so if you would, you know, if you want to look at photographs, I have some on my website. There is a Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt adaptation on the articles page on my website, and also there is a link to Machine Granite of Ancient Egypt that shows some of the same kind of technologies or cuts.
Okay, well, what does this prove, this radial formation of this slab?
Well, there has been Petrie wrote in the 1800s, Sir William Flinders Petrie, who was one of the world's first Egyptologists, wrote in the 1800s about the ancient Egyptians using circular saws. He wrote about that in his book, Pyramids and Temples of Egypt. that which was published in 1883, but he didn't describe very clearly how big the sores were. And it's the size of the sores which is significant and which are actually imprinted in this piece of granite at Abu Rawash. And it's a huge diameter saw that they used in to cut this thing. And the cut is cut in such a way, and the tool marks are evident to show that it was a saw that actually cut this, or a rotating device that cut it. But the saw diameter is over 37 feet in diameter. And we really, it's a mega saw. We do not think in those terms as far, I didn't even think in those terms in terms of how the ancient Egyptians were cutting their stones for the pyramids or for the temples I never considered it in that scale. But here,
well, that's a huge scale. 37 feet diameter is hard for us to visualize.
It is, and when I first did the calculations, because you can calculate the diameter of the saw by knowing the arc, the chord, and then the distance from the arc length or the sagitta from a straight line across the piece down to the radius, and so you have your chord length and your arc height, and then you can calculate what the radius is, and the radius looking at from along the length of it, the radius is 23.95 feet, and then looking down from the top, you have a radius of 23.684 feet. So that is actually over 47 foot in diameter. But because you see a compound radius, that means the saw was on an angle, or the piece was pushed into the saw on an angle. And so you're looking at really a segment of an ellipse, which appears as a radius. And if you do the calculation of the two radiuses, then you come up with a saw diameter of 37 feet, just over 37 feet.
What could have driven such a blade?
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, the imagination is let loose, and you have to consider, okay, what would drive a saw that is 37 foot diameter? How would such a saw be used? You know, because if a saw like that is fixtured above ground, would you have to lift the block half the diameter of the saw so that you could push it through the saw, similar to how we use a table saw? The answer to those questions are found near the pyramids, not just at Abu Rawash, but also at Giza. And at Abu Rawash, near where this block of granite was found, is what is known as a boat pit. And this is just a gash in the ground that I have labeled saw pits, because they're about 20 feet deep, and they're over 37 feet long. They're wide at the wide at the top and narrower at the bottom. And they have been labeled by Egyptologists to be boat pits, where the pharaohs had right. their symbolic solar boats that carried them into the Duat. But the more practical purpose for them, especially on what was at one time a very busy construction site, was to house gigantic circular saws that were used to very quickly and efficiently cut the blocks that went into the pyramid. And here at Abu Rawash, you have evidence of one block that was cut in a very unusual way, but it gives clear evidence of what the diameter of the saw was. And in this particular case,
this site, Abu Rawash, is still off of the main circuit. You can't really get in there without permission, right?
I was able to go there in 2006 several times. It is off the road. I mean, it's not on the on the tourist venue. But you know, I hired a taxi driver. He knew where to go. We essentially drove down the Alexandria Road, and then he darted off through a hole in a fence and started off uphill, dodging boulders all the way, and came up to a hut where this guard came over, and you know, we got a little backsheesh for the guard, and off we went up to the pyramid.
That's the way it works.
Then,
you know, if you've got the potential to have such gigantic blades, then you obviously have some enormous capacity for power. So I hope we'll be talking about that. And that raises the question, the ever unresolved question of how were those stones lifted? Because I like to think of esoteric terms. I have my ideas. But obviously, if you've got a gigantic piece of equipment that can drill like that, and you've got a power source to run such a blade, you may very well have some machinery that can actually lift these stones. Do you have opinions about that?
Well, I have beliefs.
And
opinions, yes, certainly. I haven't really changed my opinion since I wrote the Giza Power Plant, and in the Giza Power Plant, I have a chapter on Coral Castle, and Ed Leitz-Garland, who built Coral Castle in Homestead, Florida, claimed that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built, and he demonstrated a technique. He didn't tell anybody what the technique was or how he did it, but he was able to lift single-handedly 30-ton blocks of stone and move them around, 22-ton obelisk, 30-ton block, and over the course of, I think, 28 years, he constructed a castle comprising 1,100 tons of coral that he quarried locally and also at a place called Florida City. But he wouldn't let anybody in on his secret.
He
took it to his grave. He did write a very unusual book, though, called "A Book for Every Home," in which the intention or the focus on the book was how to raise a young lady. And
you mentioned that in your interview with me, and you think that it's got hidden codes in it, right?
Well, there is maybe something in that book that was hidden, because he said in the book, you know, for the reader who disagrees with anything that he says in the book, he's left as an equal amount of space for the reader to write their own story. And opposite each page in the book is a blank page. So.
Well, also the title, you know, How to Raise a Young Lady.
Yes. I mean, the intention of the book was How to Raise a Young Lady, and it's a very, very weird book that if you read it, you know, with the modern mindset, you would say that Ed Leitz-Garland was a sexist, or, you know, he was really old-fashioned, and he would have raised a young lady in a very harsh way.
But my suggestion is the word raised is already a clue that a book may very well be talking about how to raise the stones, how to lift the stones.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the thing is he refers to his Sweet 16, you know. And, you know, I think he was an unusual fellow, you know. He had a distrust of the government, of the military, and in fact he was visited by both, but he wouldn't give them any of his secrets.
Thank goodness for that. Well, Sweet 16 also might be some kind of a ratio, or I agree with you that there must be a purpose to that book that is very different than what it appears to be on the surface.
There's definitely a continuing mystery there.
Yeah, well, thank God he didn't give it to the military. All right, well, let's get to part something that really interests me a lot is the famous tubes with the serpent in them that you find in the crypt at Dendera. Yeah. I just took a group of people there, and we got into the crypt. And I'd like to ask you, can you tell us, obviously, if we're talking about electricity and power, then those two images are very important. And what do you propose in your book about that?
Actually, you know, I went to Dendera, and I dealt with the tubes or the so-called Dendera light bulb that it's been popularly labeled in the Giza power plant. And in 2006, I went to Dendera to follow up on the research on that. And the Dendera light bulb has became a very controversial kind of topic. And so I don't discuss it in the Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. There are other things, other reliefs in the crypt also that I am very, very interested in. I'm going to follow up on in a forthcoming book. But what I focused on at Dendera at the time was the Hypostyle Hall and the incredible architecture and the precision of the alignment of the columns, and particularly the capitals with Hathor's image at the Hypostyle Hall. So as far as the Dendera light bulb, I think Eric von Daniken got involved in some research there, and he had an electrical engineer build a replica based on what we see in the relief in the crypts, and it worked. So, I think there are, you can interpret that particular relief as being evidence or, you know, evidence of them having knowledge of electricity. I definitely believe that they had a lot more knowledge or a lot greater technology than what we see or what we've been taught.
Well, I mean, the drill itself, the blade itself implies, the nature of the blade implies that there had to be a power to drive it.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, those who the orthodox thinkers would say, or those who hold to the belief that the ancients didn't have electricity would say, well, you could drive it with manpower, like a capstan or something like that. But I wrote the Giza power plant and proposed that they were creating electricity with the Great Pyramid. They certainly had a greater knowledge of science and technology, and they knew electricity. And to me, it's just a given that they were using much higher levels of technology than what we've given them credit for. The saw blade. How do they drive that? There are other artifacts that you see, such as the statues at Luxor. How did they cut those statues? I believe that they were machined. What drove the machines? There's just so much evidence that when you look at it in a different way, the genius of the ancients actually comes to life, and you do see a picture of a civilization that is a lot greater. One point that I make in my book, and I think that it's useful to repeat here, is that you talked earlier about the advances that we've made in 100 years, and the advances that we made are incredible. I mean, I've been in manufacturing for almost 50 years, and from when I walked into an engineering company back in 1961 to today, The differences are startling, unbelievable, the advances that have been made over the last 50 years. Over 100 years, the advances have been even more incredible. So what is really puzzling and what I bring out in my book is the Egyptian civilization supposedly lasted 3,000 years. And the artifacts that have been studied by Egyptologists and what are described in books on Egyptology were created at the beginning of the civilization using copper tools, stone balls, copper, stone chisels, wooden mallets, simple tools. 3,000 years later, the civilization is using stone balls, copper chisels, stone chisels, wooden hammers. And to say that the genius that we see in the structures is reflective of a mind of a very, very intelligent and clever civilization, and to say that those people did not improve on their tools in 3,000 years is probably the biggest mystery that Egyptologists have ever written about, because it's counterintuitive, it's impossible for them not to improve on their tools. So when we look at the timeline for when these artifacts were created, including the pyramids, I think we have to go further back in time.
Indeed. Your book talks about the lost technologies of, this is the title, The Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. So what is the basic premise? What kind of technology? Because let's say that we agree completely that it's ludicrous to think that they were not having peaks, and in a society such as this, to think that they were not capable of developing tools, considering their vision and their sophistication, and their symmetries and geometries, which you go into a lot in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that. And when you're focused on this book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, your focus on Ramses, the statue of Ramses, and all of the incredible geometries and the purpose for some of this work, which you present as being more than just, obviously, just symbols of beauty.
Yes, that's an interesting story in of itself. My history with Ramses takes me back to 1986, when I was looking down the statue of the Ramses lying on its back in the Open Air Museum at Memphis, which is a few miles south of Cairo. And it struck me very odd that the left and right nostrils on Ramses' nose were identical mirror images to each other. And it's always been my understanding, and I think it's true, that no adult has identical nostrils. At least I don't, and nobody I've ever known has identical nostrils. So it seemed significant to me at the time, and of course it still is. A complete study of the Ramses statue could fill an entire book. I devoted four chapters to Ramses, and it was a narrative of my numerous trips to Egypt and investigating ancient Egyptian craftsmanship. And it started off, of course, in 86, but then in 2004, when I was at Luxor, my attention was drawn to these granite objects that were sitting in front of a truncated Ramses statue in the Ramses Hall. And these were the white crowns of Upper Egypt. They are a conical-shaped crown known as the Hedjet, and sometimes they combine with the Deshra, which is the crown of Lower Egypt, to become the Peshent. And that symbolizes the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt. Many, many statues can be seen with these crowns sitting on top of the head of the pharaoh. In the Ramses statues, the crowns had fallen, evidently, and were placed in front of the statues that are situated in the hall. The white crown is a conical crown, and I was able to actually run my hands over the surface of these of the granite, and I was really impressed with the feel of the craftsmanship. And it was, you know, there was no pits, dips, raised surfaces. It was a truly very, very smooth contour. And it was as though I was witnessing the same kind of work that was produced by a precision modern machine. But this is obviously created many, many years ago. That was the first impression with Ramses at Luxor. But it kind of gnawed on me for years after that. That was in 2004. So in 2005, I decided I had to go back, and I signed up to go with John Anthony West on a tour in 2006, and took a fairly decent digital camera with me. But what I discovered, and to cut a long story short, because obviously the book is 400 pages, and I'm going to give you the cliff notes here. What I found was that these crowns were actually ellipsoids, in that they are partial ellipsoids anyway.
And okay, what's an ellipsoid? Remember, you're talking to non-engineer person and probably your audience as well.
Yeah, I apologize for that. If you look at an ellipse is actually, if you take a cylinder and you cut that cylinder or a cone, and you cut the cylinder or cone or a section of it, and you look at it from a particular axis, you will see that it is elliptical shaped. Similarly, if you look at, say, I have a coffee cup in my hand, and I look at the lid or the top of the coffee cup at an angle, not straight down, which is a circle, but if you look at it as an angle, at an angle, you see that what you're looking at resembles an ellipse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Hold on a minute. I just have a caller coming in. Are you in the middle of concluding that thought?
Well, what I'm saying is that the ellipse is basically a circle seen at a different orientation. Now, if you take an ellipse, which you can actually describe an ellipse on a piece of paper, but if you take an ellipse and you spin it around its axis, its long axis, and it becomes a solid, then that's what you have with these crowns in Luxor.
So what is the significance of this?
Well, the significance is the geometry of the ellipse wasn't supposed to have been known by the ancient Egyptians. Not only that, when you have a solid ellipsoid that is crafted into granite and crafted with precision, then you have to have a control mechanism in order to do that, because to achieve that by hand is impossible.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, we have our mutual friend Stephen Mailer calling in on the line, so I guess he wants to put his two cents in.
Okay,
so
good old Stephen.
Is that you, Stephen?
Ciao, cara Patricia.
Hello, my darling. How nice to
Hello, my mate. Hello, mate.
I guess your ears were burning. Your name has come up a couple of times already, so thanks for calling in.
Well, I would just like to let everybody know, from my perspective, the significance of the book that Christopher has written. And people know that I've formerly been studying Egypt for about 42 years. It's actually almost 55 years, my interest in the field. And people must realize the depth of what Christopher has done here. He's not been given full credit. As you mentioned earlier in this discussion, Christopher has made two major discoveries in the field, which, of course, Egyptology has not recognized. One, when he was being videoed in 1999 when we were doing a conference together in Egypt, and floodlights were put on the upper wall of the Grand Gallery of the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid, Christopher observed that the upper wall is of granite, not limestone, like has been properly believed. And it is a very significant find. Again, has no ripple in the field. And as you mentioned, at Abu Lawash, and I'm grateful for the fact that because of our beloved Hakim, I am the one who has introduced Abu Ruwash to the world. Very few people before the 90s ever went to Abu Ruwash, ever commented on it. It was just dismissed as a site where there was an obscure pyramid that had collapsed, blah, blah, blah. Well, I read about it in Land of Osiris. Christopher picked up on it, and he went back and found this major discovery that you guys have been discussing, and which I will take you to see if you come to Egypt with me. It is a contoured slab of granite, as Christopher described. It is incredible. Christopher also mentions the fact that Abu Ruwash is a large ditch, which he postulates may have held the great saw that cut those blocks, and we're going to look at that, too, when we're there at Abu Ruwash. So I want the world to know this book...
Stephen, you need to move the mouthpiece away a little bit because your voice is breaking up.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just want everybody to know that this book is a major, major resource in the field that will be quoted and referenced for many, many years to come. People always ask me what books to recommend in the field of Egyptology. Well, there is no other than Lost Technologies in Ancient Egypt and the two books that you've written this year. Otherwise, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing new in the field. But Christopher has made it a tremendous addition to the field, and this is why, again, he always likes to use the quote, "Rabbit Shock put it the best of any of us who reviewed the book." Christopher Dunn has indisputably proved that the ancient Egyptians had an advanced technology that has never been fully recognized.
You're the best, Stephen. Thank you for the wonderful plug for me, too, and, of course, the endorsement of Chris, which is unquestioned. I mean, this is, I read this book thinking, oh, if only I had some engineering knowledge, because I try to see things through Chris's eyes and imagine him, like when he's describing feeling the granite and recognizing sophistication of the carving and recognizing the elliptic and this kind of incredible perspective, not only knowledge, but perspective that he's able to receive and embrace and bring to the experience. It's monumental information.
Yes.
Okay.
Let me just add one more thing, because before I called in, I was just playing with the mouse on my computer. If everybody looks at their mouse on their computer and sees the carving on the plastic, how it fits a perfect radius, perfect form, that is done, as Christopher points out, by a computer. They can do that by computer programs now, which sets a machine that makes a perfect arc, and this is in plastic. What Christopher has observed is the same things in granite and in limestone in ancient Egypt. They didn't have computers to guide the saw blade or the carve of the art, but they must have had some type of device, because it's obviously machined. People look at the mouse on their computer, it's the same kind of texture form as the statues of Ramses that Christopher's talking about. And that is such a brilliant this discovery.
The question comes, and this is a question that Chris and I delved into the last time I had him on. What happened to this equipment? Where is it? Chris?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Stephen for his comments. And, you know, I do say in my book that Stephen gets more excited about my work than I do sometimes. So thank you, Stephen. the irrepressible Dr. Mailer, he's just an awesome supporter. Thank you, Stephen. God bless you. I think both Stephen and I agree that there was a cataclysm that happened in prehistory that must have destroyed that civilization. And we're just looking at the skeleton of the civilization right now. But Stephen's own book, Land of Osiris, tells a totally different story than From Light into Darkness, tells a different story about the Egyptian history through the oral tradition, which is, I think, a lot more supportive of the of our view that there was a more advanced civilization in the past, and we need to recognize that, and we need to give credit where credit is due.
And more than that, I mean, let's take it a little step further. And great, so we established that there was this wonderful advanced civilization in the past, which quite honestly is a no-brainer considering the magnitude of what Egypt still is today. But what it means for the future, what can we take from this? What can we create? What can we do for this planet with this information? When are we going to get to some of the truly hidden Well, let's talk about it. We've got all this information coming about of the hidden chambers, more information about the underneath the pyramid, the city. It never ends. We still believe we're about to come upon some Atlantean technology. Of course, Hockey will be rolling in his grave if he hears me say that. But certainly what we want to bring forward from this conversation is, great, establish that there was this immense, intelligent, phenomenally advanced civilization. What are the implications for the future of humanity, which is, quite honestly, at the breaking point?
And I think I can only speak for myself and from my own personal inner, I would say, mindset, if you will, and how or philosophy and how it has changed over the years. But it certainly has given me a different perspective of different cultures, a different view of and respect for different cultures, because people who are raised in a particular environment in a particular society have never stepped outside their own particular culture or environment generally have a warped sense of reality in terms of the total human society at large. And it's given me a lot more respect for cultures that we have previously seen as not quite as advanced as Western civilization. So that's one. The other one is, you know, the mortality of the human body. We accept, but we always seem to believe or comforted by the continuity of our genes, if you will, through our children, or the continuity of civilization. And we tend to work towards making sure that future generations are continue with our, you know, the mission of improvement or continuous improvement of the soul and of life in general.
Yes.
And to actually come to the realization that it's not really about the continuation of the material things. It's the continuation of the spirit that really counts, because everything comes from the spirit and everything ultimately goes back to spirit.
Oh, that is a beautiful way to end this program, and that is why I chose you to be in the book, Beyond the Matrix, the Blending of Science and Spirit, because you do it so eloquently in your work. And Stephen, too, all of us trying to merge those two aspects that have for so long been on the other sides of the fence, only to know that at the end, the human condition is the search for this meaning in life. And that is reflected throughout society after society and in great eloquence in Egypt. Chris, unfortunately,
right,
we are already out of time, and I just don't understand how it's possible. But let me quickly tell people again, you've been listening to my friend and great contributor to the human wisdom of the past and the present, Christopher Dunn. His book is Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, Advanced Engineering in the Temples of the Pharaohs. His website is www.gizapower.com. Read this book. It will really, like Stephen said, it is going to be a changing perspective, new paradigm contribution to the Egyptian story, the never-ending story of an Egypt that simply remains the enigmatic mystery of all time. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Patricia. It's been a pleasure.
Very grateful. Thank you. And for all of you, come with me. I'm changing my mind. I was planning to go to Egypt in November next. It looks like I'm going to go much sooner in February, maybe of February 2nd, 2011 would be 224. That's 224. That's the fool. That's me. We will go into the Great Pyramid and sing in the key of F sharp, and see if we can feel what Christopher is trying to teach us. Thank you all. I'm, by the way, one last thought. I'm looking for a sponsor for this program. If you're an author or someone who's doing work for the good of all humankind and you'd like to reach my audience, please get in touch with me, patcorey@tiscali.it. I'll be taking a few very select sponsors for the show. All right, that's it. Beyond the Matrix. Next week, I have Andrew Collins on. We're going to be back in Egypt talking about the caverns below. Lots of controversy. Don't miss it. And thank you, as always, for listening to Beyond the Matrix, the program that dares you, implores you to think outside the box of conventional thought. Bye-bye.